Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the second half of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for listening. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys. You can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, you can send me an email. I would love to hear from you, SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. I give a lot of things away, books, CDs, tickets to movies, tickets to dinners at restaurants, all kinds of things. But I would just love to hear from you. And I also try to inform people about a lot of opportunities, scholarships, programs, whether you're an artist or economics person, whatever it is, I try to get a lot of information out. So try to follow me on Twitter.com/JoyKeys. Right now, I'm just bowing down to my guest that I have on air next, Ellis Coates. I mean, he is a writer, and he's a filmmaker, he's an author, he's worked at the New York Daily News, he's a contributing editor for Newsweek. He's been on the Today Show, Nightline, Dateline, ABC World News, Good Morning America, PBS. Some of his books are Bones to Pick, The Ending of the World, The Best-Selling, The Rage of a Privilege Class. Today we'll be speaking about his newest book, The End of Anger. And I believe he's on the line right now. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Ellis Coase.
Hi, Ellis Coase. This is Joy Keys.
Hi. How are you?
Hi, thank you so much for calling in. I want to just praise you for all the wonderful books that you have written, the program you've done, Against the Odds, just the work that you do. Your whole plethora is just amazing, and I just want to bow down to you for all that you have done and presented to the world and try to get people to think differently.
Well, I deeply appreciate that. Thank you very much.
I want to read a poem, and I think once I read it, you'll know why I'm reading it, Ellis. I mean, we'll go into a little bit about your life, where you started from, and then the book, End of Anger. This is by Gwendolyn Brooks, Speech to the Young, Speech to the Progress Toward. So it says, say to them, say to the downkeepers, to the sun slappers, to the self-soilers, the harmony hushers, even if you are not ready for day, it cannot always be night. You will be right, but that is the hard home run. Live not for the battles won. Live not for the end of the song. Live in the along. Gwendolyn Brooks, Speech to the Young. Mr. Coase, now I think you know why I read Gwendolyn Brooks. Can you talk to me about your relationship with Gwendolyn Brooks?
Sure. I mean, Gwendolyn Brooks was one of my more important mentors. I basically reached out to her when I was a kid. I was, I think, 16 at the time, and was trying to become a writer. And I sent her some things I had done, and she took me under her wing, as she did, I guess, any number of other young writers, though I think I might have been one of the youngest, and invited me to join her writers group. And was quite a positive and encouraging influence. And for someone like I was just going to say, for someone like myself, who was born in Chicago and who was originally from a set of housing projects in Chicago, to have the affirmation of someone like Gwendolyn Brooks, who was a Pulitzer Prize winning poet, and at that point was a poet laureate of Illinois, was something very powerful.
Well, one of the things that I thought was funny when I was just learning about you and your life and your work is that you didn't like English at first. And you were saying in the interview, talking about you didn't like English, and you were really good at math. What you sent to Gwendolyn Brooks, let me tell the audience, he's making it sound like, oh, he just sent this little thing. It was a manuscript about the history of riots. Talk to the audience about that a little bit.
Obviously you've done some research. I mean, I was at that time, I guess I was my last year of high school. I had always had a problem with English teachers because I just found English to be a very unchallenging subject as it was taught in the schools in Chicago. And so I was being resistant to doing the assignments. And the teacher had an argument with my teacher about the assignment, and ultimately she said, well, if you won't do the assignment that we want you to do, what is it that you propose to do? And I told her, well, it seems to me that the point of this class, the point of English class, is to for me to be able to show you that I know how to use the English language, know how to do research, know how to write, so why don't you let me do that? And she said, well, okay, well, what do you mean? I said, well, let me research something I'm interested in, and I'll write something for you. And she said, well, okay, well, what do you think you want to do? And I said, well, I think I want to do something on riots and on the riots in Chicago and the riots in U.S. history, because, and I picked that subject because, as I mentioned, I was from Chicago. I was from the west side of Chicago, which had been devastated mm-hmm. by two huge riots when I was quite young. And I was, and that was a subject that fascinated me. So she said, go ahead and do it. And I suddenly, for the first time, got really jazzed about English, got really turned on by English class, and ended up producing a manuscript. I don't remember exactly how long it was, but I think it was 140, 150 pages by the time it was all done. And the teacher, you know, took it, read it, and she said to me, she said, look, I'm going to give you an A in this class. She said, but I'm not really capable of judging this work. You need to send it to a professional. And I go, a professional? Well, a professional what? Who? What are you talking about? You know, and she was the one who suggested Gwendolyn Brooks because she knew of Gwendolyn Brooks' work and I think had taken a course with her at some point. And I sent it to Gwendolyn Brooks, and Gwendolyn Brooks, a few weeks later, called me at home and invited me to come and meet with her. And so I went out. She was teaching at a college on the far north side of Chicago. It took me probably over an hour to get there on the bus. I didn't drive at the time. And that was, for me, a sort of turning point meeting in my life, because after we sat down, Mrs. Brooks looked at me and she said, well, Ellis, I don't know what you plan to do with your life, but you have a talent, and one day you will be a great writer, and you should be writing. And that was a meeting which, in a very short time, it ended up changing my life.
Wow. I mean, that's just amazing. In many of your books, you talk about choices and people at the crossroads, and if they had certain things, would they be who they are today? That's something that runs through this book, The End of Anger. I'll be giving away copies of your book, so please follow me on twitter.com/JoyKeeve or become a fan on Facebook. Also, check out EllisCoates.com to learn more about Mr. Coates and his work and his Against the Odds series. You open this book, The End of Anger. One of the first chapters is Revising a Racial Contract. And I have to tell you, I was laughing with your interviews with the Tea Party people, Bill Hennessy and Deneen. I just was like, what? Like, I couldn't wrap my head around what they were saying. It's like, for example, I just want to read, this is from one of the first parts here. I'm not going to denounce any specific organization. I will tell you I will have nothing to do with the Council of Conservative Citizens personally. I won't. I don't know enough about them to condemn the organization. Talk to me about this.
Part of the research for this book, the core of the End of Anger is really a look at African Americans, particularly two groups of very privileged African Americans, and how they see their life options and their place in the workplace. But it's also a larger book looking at race in America. And in that sense, in that context, I thought it important to take a look at the Tea Party. And so I interviewed several Tea Party people, most of them white and one of them black, to get some sense of why it was they were so angry, why it was that they have launched this movement to, as they put it, take the country back. And the gentleman you quoted was the Tea Party's spokesperson, who essentially was arguing that that their movement had nothing to do with race, but two, they were all about economic betterment. But when pressed about what they really wanted, and when pressed, because they have been asked by Ben Jealous, the president of the NAACP, to denounce a lot of the racists who had aligned themselves with the Tea Party, and they basically refused to do that. And his explanation was that he just hadn't looked at a number of these groups, which clearly, you know, is public knowledge that they were taking racist positions, and their positions are quite in detail spelled out on their websites and whatnot. But the Tea Party people, at least as I understood what they were saying to me, were extremely reluctant to distance themselves from known racist groups, and I expect part of that is because they know that part of their support comes from such groups.
Their funding comes from maybe those particular groups, so they don't want to break off the relationship, you know.
Well, I'm not so sure about the funding, but I think they certainly have a constituency, and a large part of that constituency, it seems to me, that Tea Party constituency is a constituency of people who are very nervous about where they perceive America as being today, and part of where they perceive it as being as a country that they look up and there's a black president, they look around and there's an increasingly Latino population. You know, they are nervous about what they see as the end of a particular kind of society that they once had, our society, which they cannot articulate, or at least won't articulate clearly, but clearly what they are talking about is a society that was much whiter and much less minority oriented.
Yeah, one of the things you talk about in your book is that you break the book. I think the meat of your book talks about the generational differences that people have. You break
right.
the generations down on both sides, black and white. You have Gen 1, Gen 2, Gen 3, and you look at it from, you get interviews from the black side and from the white side of those different generations and how they perceive, because really it's perception to some degree. But one of the things that the groups that you talked about, or you talked to, I should say, or interviewed, a Better Chance program, talk
right.
to us a little bit about that program.
Yeah, I did two large surveys for the book. I mean, one was of graduates of Harvard Business School, the black alumni of Harvard Business School, and the other was of alumni of a program called A Better Chance, which is an interesting program. I mean, it's a program that's been in existence since the 60s, and what it does is it takes young people from urban areas, overwhelmingly black and Latino, and sends them to some of the best prep schools and best selective high schools in the country. And so, and they end up doing quite well, as you can imagine. Even though most of them start off in quite modest circumstances, only a fourth of the people who I surveyed from ABC, for instance, had parents who had finished college. And most of them live in communities that are quite poor. But by the time they get finished with the ABC program, they are in a position to go on to very good colleges and usually to very successful lives. But I thought it was important to survey a couple of groups of people who were doing very well, and these are different kinds of groups who are African American, because in some sense The End of Anger is a follow-up to a book that I did over a decade and a half ago, which is called The Rage of a Privileged Class. And The Rage of a Privileged Class, which became, you know, a fairly well-known book, is essentially a look at why, at that point in history and at that time, so many African Americans were so frustrated and angry. And the basic reason why was the frustration with trying to get beyond, trying to break through what many perceived as a huge glass ceiling. And I've been meaning for any number of years to take a look again at the themes that I had addressed in Rage of a Privileged Class, and The End of Anger is my attempt to do that.
Yes, and that one of the things you talk about in the beginning of the book is about Colin Ferguson, who emptied two clips of a semi-automatic pistol, and the reason is that he resulted from rage that he felt as a black man. And later in the book, you talk with the different Harvard MBAers, and they do say that having this Harvard MBA has opened doors, and yet and still they do hit some resistance. But the resistance they hit, whether perceived or actual, depends on the generational issue. And you have a chapter where you talk about the different generation fighters, dreamers and believers. Talk to the audience about that. Fighters, dreamers, and believers.
Sure. And but let me just say before I do that, let me just say. I mean, the Colin Ferguson reference was interesting because. When I did Rage, and I said that was roughly 17, 18 years ago now, it was the first book that really looked at depth, in depth at why it was that so many African Americans who were middle class were fuming. And it just happened to coincide with this guy who had mental problems named Colin Ferguson shooting and killing a bunch of people on the Long Island Railroad. And I happened to be abroad, and when I came back from a trip, I came back to maybe 40 or 50 phone calls from journalists who wanted me to comment on this. And the reason they were asking me to comment on this was that Richard Consler, who was a lawyer for Mr. Ferguson, had said, "Well, call up Ellis Coase; he's an expert on Black Rage." And and my book was certainly not about Black. Free people suffering from this kind of pathology that would cause them to take automatic weapons and start killing people. It was about people who were struggling with the frustrations of their life. But to go back to your question, you know, which is the generational scheme. Once I did all the surveys that I had done, and I ended up getting. Well over 500 people to fill out a fairly detailed questionnaire, looking at everything from their perceptions about their quality of life to their perceptions about the opportunities that they existed or did not exist for them in their work settings. And what struck me as I began to go through these questionnaires, Joy, you know, is that there was such a striking difference. And that had and that was correlated with age.
Yeah.
I mean, in essence, the younger group was saying, we don't quite see the world the same way as our elders do. You know that that we see a world where there is some racism and we see a workplace. Where the playing field is not exactly clear. I mean, not exactly even. But we don't think that we're going to be stopped by a glass ceiling. And as I probed into that, what struck me was that what I was hearing were the voices of people who had different experiences related to the generation. So I ended up dividing my sample into cohorts, and I called the first one. You know, Generation One, Gen One, and these are labeled the fighters. You know, this was basically, you know, the civil rights generation. These were the people from Jesse Jackson, from Martin Luther King, from John Lewis, from Julian Bond. You know, the people who were on the front lines of the civil rights struggle, the ones who would come up in many cases in the segregated South or certainly in segregated settings, and whose whole life experience had been rooted in this experience of intense hostility to the whole idea of Black equality. Gen 2 was a group that immediately followed that. And these were people who were born 1945 to 1969. These were folks who were a little bit. Or maybe in some cases quite a bit too young to have been the leaders of the civil rights movement, but who were connected to it, if only through their knowledge of it and having lived through that period.
Yeah,
and,
my mother would be considered a Gen 2er, and I would be considered a Gen 3. Go ahead,
right.
Go ahead and read us one.
And these were the first wave of people, the first wave of African Americans in any large sense to go into these big corporations and these large universities, and they were the first wave, the post civil rights wave of people who marched into these institutions expecting, in many cases, to be treated with dignity and respect, and were in large measure disappointed. So the voices that you hear in the Rage of a Privileged Class are, for the most part, the voices of that generation. They were followed by what I'm calling, and I call these that generation the dreamers. I mean, the people who who basically adhered to and tried to live out, you know, the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King. The generation that follows that and is what I'm, and those people who were born 1970, 1995 is what I'm calling Gen 3. And I call that generation the believers. These are the people who came up at a time when it was not at all unusual for them to compete with whites, who have whose white peers were quite comfortable with blacks in social settings and in professional settings, and who as a consequence, you know, have a different set of experiences with whites, but who also are young enough that they have grown up at a time when African Americans are achieving things, have achieved things that earlier generations just had not seen as part
never
of their formative years. So, I mean, these
one of the things. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
So these are people who believe, who, you know, who saw Richard Parsons, for instance, take over Time Warner, who were quite young when Colin Powell became Secretary of Defense. Rather Secretary of State. You know, and who as a result never bought into the whole idea that there were the kind of limits on black success that earlier generations were forced to buy into.
Yeah, I mean, I'm considered based on your categorizing of Gen 3, and I do agree with some of the comments. But one of the things, I think one of the characters I related to, not the character, but Elijah Anderson had been on the show talking about his book, The Cosmopolitan Canopy, and
sure.
That's, you know, the different Philadelphia context and race and things of that nature. But I definitely related to this son, because I, too, was raised in a certain middle-class family, the types of schools I went to, trying to navigate as a Gen 3er between being maybe the only black person someplace with majority white and then trying to go back to the black community, whether it's going to an all-black school or black the only kids in the neighborhood. I definitely related to his story in there. That's in Chapter 6, Reaching Across the Generational Divide. And but what's interesting is I'm glad that you brought about the issue of gender,
mm-hmm. you
know, because gender and race, a double whammy for black women sometimes, and your Gen 3er self, that race kind of receded, that gender was more of an issue. But one of the most interesting is that they said a lot of older white men became their mentors. Talk to us a little bit about that. A couple of people mentioned that older white men were becoming mentors to young black women.
Just to talk a bit about the process. I mean, after we did the questionnaires, as I said, I administered well over 500 questionnaires to my respondents. We ended up doing about 140, 150 in-depth follow-up interviews, where we tried to get behind the questions and the responses in the questionnaire, and we asked people, okay, you know, what do you mean when you said X, Y, and Z, and what has your personal experience been? And that's where we got some of the more interesting responses. And we talked to certainly a number of younger black women, you know, who were describing their own experience in the corporate workplace. And I remember one in particular who said that she had been mentored by any number of white men who found themselves more comfortable, apparently, as she saw it, you know, mentoring her, perhaps, than mentoring a black man. And part of what she was also speaking to, though, was the even though things have changed, there still aren't a whole lot of black men or women at the higher echelons of corporate life. And so if you're going to be mentored, certainly the largest number of potential mentors are white males. I mean, the CEOs of La Major Corporations, 95% are white males at this point. 96% are white males at this point. And so part of what she was reflecting is in essence a new reality that a generation or two ago, the idea of white men mentoring blacks, period, and certainly mentoring black women, would have been just
unheard of,
and now that and now for at least some people, that's part of the reality that they are embracing.
Well, one of the things you hit on there was about networking and mentors, and that was a thread that ran throughout many of the stories, is that Blacks did not have the mentors. They did not have generational wealth. You talk about that. Several of the respondents talk about the issue of when things maybe go wrong or things don't work out, there's nobody to fall back on because the generationally they didn't have the ability to provide a cushion for their children. This issue of networking is important. And at the end of the book, some of the rules, the key to networking, not only in the African-American community, but networking while you're in school and a global network.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to the audience a little bit just about this issue, the importance of networking and how that opens doors for you and how doors have been closed because you're not part of the old boy network.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, part of this, just the reality of life in this country, is that because of our history, African Americans haven't had the opportunity, for the most part, to acquire the kind of wealth that whites have, and so and also haven't had the opportunity to acquire the kind of empowering social networks that whites have, and so as a result, it's much more difficult for many Blacks, even those who are well educated, to thrive in the sense that there's not much of a cushion there. The Black middle class is a lot more fragile than the white middle class because you don't have generations that have built up wealth that can help you weather these sort of hard times. And in the same sense, you are not born, for the most part, if you are African American, with a set of networks and social contacts that can guarantee your success in life, as many upper middle class whites effectively are. And so you have to create these. You create them. When you're going through school, you create them in your workplace. You create them by joining affinity groups or by joining other groups of people where you can find sponsors and basically peers who can help you along. But the big message from these successful African Americans, which is probably not a surprising message for people who know how the world works, is that no one sort of becomes successful on their own out here, and you need some kind of network that's going to help pull you along. And so a number of people in The End of Anger are expressing sort of how they deal with that set of issues and how they find a network they can plug into that will, one, help them just realize and see opportunities that are out there, but that too can help them take advantage of them.
Well, one of the interesting things too about the book is that you got white people to interview other white people, because you thought that would help with easing their answers out, their candor. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, particularly because as you mentioned, I mean, I ended up dividing my groups generationally, and I felt particularly with some of the older whites who may not be as candid with a Black person. It made sense to have them interviewed by older white people. So I recruited some interviewers, and some of the interviews they came back with were fascinating because they got these people to open up and to be quite blunt about how they saw the world. And the most interesting interview to me was a guy who I call Sam, who is a white guy, a Gen 1 white guy. He's in his early 70s now, graduate of graduate of Harvard Business School. And this is a guy who, as he described himself, was totally without prejudice. And was quite open-minded, but yet when he was asked about Black people he knew, the first person he mentioned was somebody he called, and I mean, this is a quote, somebody he called Nigger Gene.
I'm going to bring that up. I'm so glad you brought it up.
And this was a guy who, as he described him, was somewhat of a buffoon who worked for his uncle, who was a great delight to him and his peers. And then he mentioned the Black maid who worked for his mother. And when asked about his own practices in terms of hiring black people. He said, well, he had never hired, and this is a guy who once had run a tech firm in California, and he said, well, he didn't hire any black people because black people just didn't have the credentials. And when asked about black in his private club, he said, well, there weren't any because black people weren't interesting. So, you know, this is a guy.
But he's not prejudiced.
Yeah,
he's not prejudiced. And nor was the other woman who, one of them, her name Sarah, she was talking about not dating any, like, you would never date, you know, she was a good Christian woman. One of the things, though, this was they sort of fall back on this idea that they were good Christians or good Catholics or they were good people.
They were good people, and part of the point that I was making, and part of the reason that it made sense to me to look at this generationally is that these are the kinds of people, these whites who thought they were without prejudice, but who were fundamentally bigoted, that the Gen 1 and Gen 2 black folks had to contend with. And so and so their experience in the world and in the workplace reflected an experience of having to deal with whites who were unsympathetic, uncomprehending, and in some fundamental way incapable of seeing African Americans as human beings. And for a lot of the younger Gen 3s who are coming up, you know, their experience is quite different than that.
Definitely. Well, I'm one of the Gen 3s, but I would say because of my parents, I was conscious of race. I ended up actually being the president of African American Student Union at my university and just different other things. But I was made conscious because of my parents' activities. But I realized that, one, because I'm a light-skinned black woman, that many doors have been opened for me that would not have been opened for my dark-skinned girlfriends, and that whites accepted me differently and differently to me than they did to my dark-skinned friends. And I would laugh inside because they think that I didn't know how they were speaking to me. It was just funny. You know, it was like I was almost outside of myself in some circumstances. They thought they were good white people, and I was a good, quote-unquote, black person, you know. One of the things at the end of the book, you talk about the capacity for change, and that is hard sometimes for me to believe that people have a capacity for change, and I know I have changed. So there is hope, and that's something else your book talks about, hope in the chapter talking about jail and school, that you talk about hope and the capacity for change. I want to just commend you. You just are such a detailed writer and research that you do. I can see the passion in your work, not only in this book, but also let's just talk briefly, we only have a few minutes left, about Against the Odds series. Can you tell the audience about your Against the Odds series?
Sure, that's a radio series that I'm the creator of. It's a radio documentary series, and the last iteration, which was last year, we did four different documentaries, you know, looking at everything from victims of caste discrimination in India to women who had been whittled by the anti-Muslim riots in the state of Gujarat in India, and how they had put together a collective and ended up doing quite well for themselves, to the survivors of genocide in Rwanda, to former gangbangers in the United States who had gone on to make something of their lives, and also to some survivors of the foster care system. But the whole point of Against the Odds is essentially to look at people who had been forced in one way or another on the margins of their respective societies, and how they had found a way, a pathway back to hope. So it's a look at it in sort of from both a domestic sense and an international sense. I mean, the first one we did, these are hour-long radio documentaries. The first one we did was actually looking at a young guy from Somalia who had fled.
That was amazing.
Right.
He had to go to the care organization and charge up his battery and bring it back to where he was living so that he could read. I mean, that just is amazing.
Right. This is a guy named Abbas Muhammad, who got it into his head that he was going to get himself an education. And part of what he had to do was, you know, from this dirt poor place on the border of Kenya, where the refugee camp that he came up in. Yes, and to the one room schoolhouse that he went to, he managed to do so well that he got one of the top grades in the whole country on his exams, and ended up getting himself into Princeton University. You know, and so it was so for me, it was just a fascinating story of human potential, and how if that human potential is allowed to blossom even in the most unexpected places, we can just see amazing results.
Definitely. I want to thank you so much for coming on today. I want to wish you much success with all your endeavors, writing, filmmaker, journalist, so on and so forth, researcher extraordinaire. Just thank you so much for coming today. I want to encourage the listeners to pick up a copy of The End of Anger, but I'll also be giving away some copies of The End of Anger. If you were trying to get a free copy, follow me on Twitter.com/JoyKeith. Become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keith. Also, check out EllisCoates.com to learn more about Mr. Coates and his work. Just amazing talent. I'm bowing down. I'm bowing down right now to you.
Well, Joy, it's been a pleasure, and thank you very much for reaching out to me.
Thank you. Have a wonderful Saturday and a great week.
Okay, you take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Again, I've just been speaking with Ellis Coates, author, journalist, researcher extraordinaire, radio talent. I mean, he's just all over, but he is just so detailed, in-depth, passionate about the issues of hope, resiliency, capacity for change. These are threads that are running throughout his book. Do you have a capacity to change? I mean, does America have a capacity for change? I think in his book, The End of Anger, we are on the verge here of a major turnaround in this community, in this society, dealing with racism, how we view ourselves as African-Americans, how others view us. That will help, I think, us become stronger as a society. I want to thank you. Again, follow me on Twitter.com/JoyKeith. Become a fan on Facebook. Look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keith. Also, check out EllisCoates.com. You have a wonderful Saturday, and I'm going to end with Avery Sunshine. I had her on the other week, and she's just a really warm talent, and her song, I Got Sunshine. I hope you have some sunshine this week.